Hello, I'm Jonathan Mosen. The American Council of the Blind is one of the leading consumer organizations of blind people in the United States. On the Blind Line of Saturday, the 4th of September, I spoke with the Council's Executive Director, Charlie Crawford, about a range of issues. We began by defining exactly what the ACB is.
ACB is a membership organization of blind folks around the United States, and we have members in all the states of the Union. We are an organization which is based upon both a combination of state affiliates, meaning affiliates that are membership based upon geographic state, and then we have special interest groups who are also affiliates based upon particular interest in a particular thing, such as dog guide use or something like that. And so they make up a total of about 72 different affiliates for the American Council of the Blind. And the organization basically exists to promote the health and safety and welfare of blind folks in the United States. So we've got a lot of work to do in this organization.
Can you be more specific about membership numbers?
Well, I think that it's reasonable to say that we do have a database, but in terms of good standing, I would estimate about 25,000.
Where does the ACB's mandate come from? When you look at the number of blind people that there are in the US, and I guess this is a problem with consumer organizations right across the world, really, there is a very small percentage of blind people that bother to get involved in consumer organizations. Do you think that impacts on your mandate at all?
No, not at all. I mean, the mandate doesn't come necessarily from the number of members as much as it comes from the documentable need within the blindness community. The fact that a person doesn't necessarily join an organization doesn't alter the reality of the life circumstance of blind persons as experienced by the members of the organization. So to that extent, I suppose there's some credibility to the numbers issue, but for the most part, I would argue that a problem with any number of street crossings becoming more and more hazardous for any particular blind person is a problem for most blind people. So from that perspective, I suppose the mandate exists. Let me just comment for a second on the issue of the amount of people that don't get involved with consumer organizations. It is true that less than 10% of the blind community in the United States is organized. Having said that, I'm not sure that as a conscious choice on the part of people not to join organizations as much as in many circumstances they may not really have been familiarized sufficiently with consumer organizations to make a choice. In other circumstances, there clearly is an issue where people may have concluded that they're not joiners. They don't need to belong to an organization. This is not something that's peculiar to the blindness population. In most organizations of our type in the United States, has been a somewhat of a decline. But it's important to point out in terms of ACB that our membership grew by a net 2,000 people last year, and I'm anticipating even more growth than that this year for a number of different reasons.
Yes, can you talk to me a little bit about why you believe ACB is experiencing that growth?
Well, I think it's a combination of a number of factors, the most important of which is that the issues that ACB has determined to become involved with are issues that impact the average blind person on a daily basis and so are very meaningful to the average person. And those issues are identified by a process of democratic dialogue within the organization. Most of it happening at the convention itself in terms of the resolutions that the organization adopts, but a lot of it also happens through the discourse that happens when people read the Braille Forum magazine or go online and look at ACBL, which is our listserv, or ACB Announce, which is a electronic announcing system that we have. And so the issues that we have identified, such as pedestrian safety, which is a critical problem these days because of the enormous amount of change that's happening with respect to intersection construction. It used to be that there was a you know, it was pretty easy. I mean, you just cross the street and the cars would stop on all four sides and let you cross. Or, in the alternative, cars would go in one direction and you could cross the other. But as it turns out, because there's such a crying demand on the part of traffic engineers to move more traffic across the intersection in less time, the needs of pedestrians have been more or less sacrificed to that, and ultimately the net result is that it's increasingly dangerous for blind people to cross because of the amount of left turns, right turns, all of this on a red light. You know, cars coming across you when you're in a crosswalk. All those things need to be controlled, and they are controlled to an extent by reason of the fact that there's signaling devices at these intersections, and so a sighted person can easily pick up when it's okay to cross, at least by the signaling system. But a blind person hasn't had the opportunity to know that the light is turned in their favor or the walk sign has come on. So we're working very hard to try and get accessible pedestrian signaling at these intersections. Well, that's one example. Another example is the platforms on subways, where in the past there weren't detectable warning strips, and ACBs fought real hard to get those strips down in as many places as we can, and that has really helped, because in the past there were blind people that actually lost their lives simply because they may have for a moment or so not paid attention or whatever happened to cause them to fall into the subway pits. Now those issues were identified not so much by any kind of somebody going up to the mountaintop and hearing it from above, as much as they were identified by the real life experience of blind people, and as people talked about those things and got them into resolutions at the National Convention of ACB, then the organization got its mandate from the membership to go work with these kinds of issues. And they're just a few. I mean, there's a dog guide issue, for example, that we had going with the state of Hawaii, where dog guides were not really allowed in the state in a usable time frame. I mean, I think if you wanted to go to Hawaii and wait for 2 months while the dog was quarantined, I suppose you could do that, but the dog wouldn't be much use to you. Dog guide users essentially determined that something had to be done about it, and the Guide Dog Users Incorporated, which is an affiliate of ACB, and ACB itself, worked real hard to resolve it, and finally we got a settlement in a lawsuit last year after 20 years. So those are the kinds of issues that come up for people. Another thing is, you know, if you get up in the morning and you go to set your radio or use a piece of electronic equipment such as a microwave, and you find out that there's no way that you can tell the thing to do what it's supposed to do because of the digital displays on the machinery, then you end up having to do a lot of guesswork. I'm sure as a blind person you can appreciate how that is.
Absolutely.
I mean, I've done a lot of guesswork before. But the point is that maybe it's time that we stop accepting that this is the way the world is, and we just have to kind of live with it and find ways to cope as best we can. And maybe we ought to have a bit of compromise from the rest of the world in terms of at least using some kind of universal design in product manufacture, so that blind people have a fighting chance to be able to use it on an equal basis as other people without having to do all kinds of modifications to it and make it work, even if you can get it to do it then. Now, those are pretty common sense kinds of things, but unless you have an organization which is capable of articulating the issue and then moving forward in a partnership with people who are involved with that issue to change it, it never gets changed. And if it never gets changed, then blind people just basically live out the same kind of lives of quiet desperation that probably characterized our population for 18 centuries.
Coming back to the issue of pedestrian access, there are some people who say that the trick here is to ensure that organizations like yours lobby for quality training in mobility skills, and that in fact when you look at the reluctance of employers to employ blind people, the last thing we want, these people say, is for people to be scared off by expensive modifications that in some people's view aren't necessary. How do you deal with that argument?
Well, if somebody could tell me the last time an employer ever paid for modifications to the environment outside the employer's workplace, for example, a traffic light being made accessible, then I suppose I might lend some credibility to that last part of the argument. On the first part of it, with respect to training, ACB has consistently argued that good training by people who know what they're doing in assisting blind persons is critical to the success of a blind person, so that we don't have any argument with the notion of training. Our issue is that just as with a driver, for example, to go through 15 different courses in driver education, but there are still accidents. And those accidents don't happen because somebody wasn't trained in all circumstances. I would argue that in most circumstances, people are perfectly capable of driving but get in accidents anyway. If that's the case, then there has to be a reason beyond training that is the cause, and that's the same issue we have with accessible street crossings and detectable warnings at subway pits and other dangerous areas, that you really do need something to draw your attention to the fact that, you know, you need to pay attention here, and this is when you have an opportunity to go forward in a street crossing or to stop at a subway pit. So we don't buy those arguments.
One of the things that we have in New Zealand that I have not seen in my visits to the US is tactile crossings, where instead of having a noise that it could be argued distract you from hearing other traffic that's coming, you have a little pin that pops out on the pole where the light is, so that you can feel when it's time to cross, and it also makes quite an audible click. Are they being used in the US?
Well, you know, we're sort of in a period of experimentation here with respect to audible traffic signals. I mean, the vibrating arrow, for example, that's an option. What you just suggested is an option. We think that for the average person, at least our experience right now is that if there's a tone, a locator tone, as you suggested, that leads a person to where the pole is, where you would press the button, and there's an arrow on the button, on the pole, that shows the person which way the signal is going to allow them to cross, and then the signal itself is activated after holding down the button for maybe 3 seconds, and only tones at, or rings, or talks, or whatever it does, at about 5%, 5 decibels above the ambient noise levels, that should suit the needs of all parties concerned. We're very aware of those neighbors who have been sort of driven cuckoo by cuckoos, you know.
Yes, and you know, that sort of thing can cause resentment, of course.
Oh, it can. Before I became executive director at ACB, I was the commissioner of the blind for the state of Massachusetts, and we had one circumstance where a neighbor would actually go out and rip out that little chirping bird. So, you know, I guess they're kind of upset about it, you know what I mean? And, you know, that's reasonable. I think I would probably be pretty upset myself if I lived near one of those things and it was chirping all night. On the other hand, if we do have a mechanism, and we do now, to make sure that the audible noise is only within a certain distance of the intersection, and it's a low noise at that, and if ambient sound drops to almost nothing, then you'll hardly ever hear it, that's a reasonable solution.
In terms of universal design, how is the council dealing with those issues, which are very fascinating issues, particularly, you know, every time one goes out and buys a new cell phone, it's a bit of a challenge. So what's going on in that area?
Well, we have fortunate to have a lot of talented people in the American Council of the Blind. Debbie Cook, for example, is on our Environmental Access Committee, and she's reasonably expert in many phases of the electronic knowledge base. And then we have Julie Carroll, who's equally superb in terms of her ability to understand and work with various government agencies and manufacturers of equipment, and we have lots of partners too. For example, the American Foundation for the Blind, and Paul Schrader is oftentimes found with us lobbying for this or that cause. So when it comes to technologies and universal design and those kinds of things, we rely heavily upon the internal expertise we have within our committees and with our partners to identify those areas, such as the Federal Communications Commission, that would have jurisdiction over cell phones and television and communications in general, or the federal government responsible agencies for enforcement of Section 508, which is a standard-setting section of the law that requires the federal government to basically purchase accessible equipment and software. Now, we have the standards, as it were, but we don't necessarily have compliance. And compliance is, you know, a law without enforcement is not a law at all. So we not only have people who work up front in terms of developing standards and working with industry and government agencies to try and develop a reasonable expectation of design, but we also have an advocacy part of our national office. That's the Office I Direct, which is prepared and has actively gone after those sectors that have no interest in complying with accessibility issues. So, but to get back to the universal design issue, we try to incorporate the participation of any number of disability groups, as well as blind people, obviously, in developing what our baseline expectation is for what's a priority. I mean, a priority with respect to cell phones, for example, is we really would like to be able to use all the features of the phone, and we really would be able to like to be able to dial the phone without, you know, dialing Hong Kong or whatever when we're anticipating dialing San Francisco. So we sort of work with the larger community, disabled people and blind people, to develop those baseline expectations, and then we take that to manufacturing groups and trade associations that have to do with the various pieces of equipment, for example, televisions or whatever, that we need to work with, and then we hopefully are able to get them out of a voluntary effort to essentially make some universal designs and work the magic, as it were. When that doesn't work, well, then we also work with government to try and make sure that existing laws are either enforced or interpreted properly so that they can be enforced to promote universal design. I guess the most, and you're probably very familiar with this, the most, the best example that I can think of a kind of universal design effort is that whole WC3, where there's a real, I don't want to call it a fight. I guess there's a real attempt to design standards for web pages that make them accessible for everybody. And that consortia, in my view, is a good model because it really does try to get all the various parties together and work something out that works for everybody. And when we do it that way, such as in the Hawaii Dog Guide suit, for example, our discovery is that if you put out your expectation up front and you make no bones about what it is that you expect, and at the same time you honor and try to incorporate the issues that other people have in the way that you move from there, the likely outcome is that in the end everybody's going to support the solution. And even as it took litigation with respect to Hawaii to get dog guides to be able to visit the island in a meaningful time frame, we're finding that the general population and the government in Hawaii is much more happy with dog guides than one would have anticipated at the outset. And the reason for that, again, is because we take the time to hear what they have to say and try to address their issues as we work our own.
It's pretty appalling that there is a federal government who passes very worthy laws and then is reluctant to provide the resources necessary to enforce them.
Well, now we got into a discussion of the American political system, eh?
How many hours have you got?
Really, how many days do we have? It's clear that the politics in the United States operate in sometimes a strange way. I mean, in part and parcel, it's pretty common to democracy as well, that you will get what we call a mom and pop or motherhood issue that everybody agrees to, and they'll put out a big you know, a big statement of what we believe in. And then if it only goes that far, they're very happy because they don't have to spend any resources in making it happen. But be that as it may, the challenge to the advocacy community is to have the government essentially put its money where its mouth is. And there are a lot of good people in government who really are trying to get the job done, and their issues and our issues, unfortunately, sometimes get a lower priority than they really ought to. But the reality is that, you know, given the way that politics operates, you try to generalize whatever you're saying so you get the most support from the most places. Oftentimes that will be a bigger issue than those issues of blindness, although our issues to us are as big as they can get. To the average person in the street, they may not be so big. So it's our job to try and get people more excited about, more involved with our issues. And the way you get to do that, I think, is by personalizing the issue. If you can somehow convince somebody or show somebody that your issues are just another way of saying something that really gets to them, for example, accessibility to crossing streets in a safe fashion, if you can couch that argument in a way that would say to the average driver, I mean, if you had to try and get from point A to point B without connector roads and travel 50 miles out of your way to get back there, how would you feel about it? Well, then you know, they begin to empathize with what you're trying to say and what you're trying to get done. So that's part of effective advocacy, I think, and I think it is the way that you get things done in the U.S.
Is there also not a mission here to ensure that the average sighted person sees blind people as being capable, employable individuals? I mean, maybe many people wouldn't expect a blind person to be walking independently, crossing roads, going to work anyway.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, and you point out one of the baseline issues that, you know, we have here, and I'm sure that exists in other countries. It's not just a matter of public perception, it's also a matter of individual perception. And I think that the way to resolve the unemployment issue for blind people starts with every blind person. We really have to make sure that we believe in ourselves and our talents, our capabilities, and organizations of the blind, I think, provide that kind of reinforcement to a person. Because then we get to see how other folks who are blind are doing, and in many cases are doing fairly well for themselves, and that's a real confidence builder. So I think that's step one. And step two has to do with making sure we do have the opportunities and the training that we need to get ourselves ready to compete for jobs. And I think we're fairly successful in many cases anyway with that issue. But step three is probably the hardest. I mean, that's where you have to convince employers and people who are suffering from popular prejudices that this person is really an asset to be utilized rather than somebody to be avoided. And there are a lot of different ways that we try to do that. As I'm sure in your country, the issue boils down to public education is good, but as we all know, public education as an abstraction doesn't really work very well. I mean, conceptually, everybody can agree that blind people ought to get the breaks, but then when you get down to brass tacks as to what those breaks mean, then, you know, it becomes a different story. It's kind of like not in my backyard stuff. So then, you know, we have to really rely upon the partnership between consumers and professional organizations like rehab to work with industries and softening up employers in terms of their attitudes so that we can get people into interviews and then just get them working. Once a blind person gets working, then we conclude, and I think rightfully so, that employers oftentimes will say, well, you know, I was just acting out of fear rather than any kind of realistic assessment of this person's abilities. But, you know, that partnership is important. Enforcing anti-discrimination law is important, and it's real hard for a blind person that finally gets a job or comes close to getting a job to have to then go and file a complaint with some government agency. That's you know, easier said than done. And I always encourage people who are find themselves in situations either where they're blatantly discriminated against, for example, a social worker who's all trained and ready to go, but then the agency says, well, you need a driver's license. Those kinds of things. It's real hard for somebody to say to themselves and to the employer, well, this is just unfair. But it really is unfair. And unless they get from a point where they're more concerned about the employer's reaction and less concerned about their own well-being, I think that creates a real problem. So from ACB's point of view, we try to educate our members and other consumers in ways that you can positively assert yourself so that when you do get to a situation where you may have a job either to get or have one to keep, you can do that. And that's the way you have to deal with the unemployment situation. And remember, it's equally important to say that even though we have this statistic about 70 to 79% of people who are eligible for employment are not working, we also, I think, have the reality of a blossoming population of more elderly blind persons. We have a major growth in multi-disabled blind persons. We have any number of issues that people confront when they have benefits from the government, such as Social Security disability insurance. And to get a job might mean losing those benefits. There are a lot of reasons for that, unemployment rate beyond discrimination.
Where does that figure come from, that 70 to 79%?
Well, my personal opinion is that somebody made it up one day, to tell you the truth. I think it comes from one of those popular polls that they did, or Census Bureau stuff. My experience as commissioner in Massachusetts, and I will readily admit that Massachusetts is not necessarily typical of all the states in the country, but we were nowhere near 79% unemployment rate in Massachusetts. I mean, it may have been around 35% perhaps, and that's still huge compared to the other population. But the reality is that however they came up with that number, I just have no idea.
Yes, it's interesting because it's often quoted, and in the middle of a master's thesis I've just completed, I was looking for an academic reference for that statistic and couldn't find one.
Well, there you go. You're not going to find it academic or otherwise. I mean, I shouldn't be so flip about it. I guess there's data from either the Census Bureau or from the Harris polls that showed that level of unemployment. And I'd really have to research it myself, because I've never really given enough credibility to that to do a whole lot of research on it, except to look at the statistics from the vantage point of the Vocational Rehabilitation Agency in Massachusetts, which we had the records. We had the number of people in the Commonwealth, and we had the real situation they were in. And so, you know, we could prove that it just was nothing near that. Now, again, I have to say that that's not necessarily as Massachusetts goes the rest of the country. We don't know that. But I would suspect that the unemployment rate for blind people is still very high. And so we shouldn't downplay the fact that there's a lot of unemployment out there, because it certainly is.
I have seen comments on the mailing lists from Americans who say that neither consumer organization pays sufficient attention to unemployment, that unemployment is the number one problem facing working age blind people today, and that one of the reasons why participation in consumer organizations is relatively minimal is that there is an underrating of the unemployment problem among consumer organizations. How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the frustration that people have, and I guess I have to say a couple of things. One is we can't blame doctors for the fact that their people die. We certainly can't hold the organizations of the blind responsible for the social impact of unemployment that is caused primarily from outside the blind system, for sure. So having said all that, what does that leave us with? Well, I think it leaves us with a couple of things that are worth people thinking about. The first is that the organizations, both organizations, pay a lot of attention to trying to provide information about employment opportunities, to working with the rehabilitation and governmental systems that are responsible for training people and helping people find jobs, to working with the overall general workforce development system in the United States to try and make sure it's more user-friendly to blind people, to work against discrimination in the workplace. We've had, you know, lots of advocacy activities and lawsuits to do all that. Despite all of those efforts, it's important to realize that, one, the problem is enormous, so whatever impact you have may not necessarily... it's big to the people it benefits, but not necessarily in the overall equation. How much can you really do with the resources you have, which is the other issue. I mean, can blindness organizations muster the amount of resources it would really take to make a big dent in some of these areas? Well, I'm not sure that we can. And so I don't say all that to excuse the unemployment problem, but I say all that to realistically put it in its proper perspective. And beyond that, I mean, I think that there are issues out there that blind people, whether they're employed or unemployed, are very much concerned about. One is the economic welfare of people. I mean, if you're unemployed, you clearly have a big interest in what's going on with Social Security. And even if you are employed, you're going to have some interest in whether you can maintain any benefit levels and that sort of thing. Healthcare is important to blind people. The ability to move around in the environment safely and to have an environment which is friendly to our mobility interest is important to blind people. Having the ability to access information, whether we're on the job or off the job, whether it's computers or a movie theater and DVS is important to blind people. All these kinds of issues have to be balanced out against each other. So the criticism that consumer organizations may not be doing enough about unemployment. Well, if it's legitimate at all, it's only because we don't have necessarily all the resources that we need to do that. And it's very tempting when you're unemployed, and I was unemployed and lived on SSI for a number of years, to basically look outside of your own situation and blame almost every other piece of the environment other than what you need to be doing for yourself. And so I'm not saying that all people are in that circumstance, but there certainly are those that are.
You said the longer you're unemployed, the more difficult it is, as a rule, to obtain work. How did you manage to pull yourself out of that mire?
I think it depends on what your goals are. I mean, if you want to be president, you might be unemployed forever. Who knows? You might be president too. but there are two things that I did, I guess. One was I became more open to other kinds of opportunities other than those that I was primarily interested in. And secondly, I made a conscious decision that it was time for me to go to work and to, you know, I'll be honest with you, and the rest of the world, I guess. All my friends were getting married and getting jobs, so it wasn't much fun anymore. And this is back when I was in my 20s, so I decided, well, I better get my act together and do something about this. And fortunately, I had some friends and associates that were able to work with me in finding employment opportunities, and the state was successful in being able to work out a deal with one of the state agencies to get me a startup job that I eventually became full-time and on equal par with everybody else. But it's a hard decision to do. I think the longer people stay unemployed, the most dangerous thing about it, in my view, is that they begin to lose the expectation that they ever will become employed. And that's where consumer organizations, I think, are really needed. We need to support people through that process. We need to be there for people to know that it's possible to get it done and to go and do it.
Does the ACB have a position on a non-income-tested or means-tested allowance to compensate for the cost of disability even when someone is working?
I don't know that we've ever adopted any kind of official position on that. I think we have. We clearly have been supportive of income maintenance payments in the form of SSI or other payments. When it gets into the area of employment and a sort of flat pension, I'm not sure that we've ever taken a position in support or against it.
One thing that I have been asked to ask you is about the ACB's relationship with Microsoft and what the ACB is doing to continue to improve access to Windows and operating systems that may be on the horizon.
That's a fair question, and it's a question that I'm not sure I can answer. I suppose I could answer it in any number of ways, but the bottom line is predicting the future in terms of what ultimately will result from our relationship with Microsoft is probably is about as good as predicting the weather forecast for the next 4 years. I mean, I think we can reasonably say that we have a good relationship with Microsoft. I think they are certainly at a point now where they are endorsing, supporting, and within their own company, as they call it, evangelizing accessibility for people with disabilities, and that's all to the good. I think they've committed resources. I know they committed resources and manpower to the problems. They've got the same problem that any other large organization has, and that is that even though certain parts of the organization may be enlightened to the interest of disabilities, not all parts of the organization see that as the highest priority. And so getting that message across within the organization and then making product development reflect that commitment, those are not the most easy things to do in the world. Having said all that, though, it's clear that in contrast to other companies, given the volume of business that Microsoft does and its large corporate nature, I think they've advanced by great leaps over the last 3 or 4 years to a point where baseline products such as Windows Explorer, I mean, like, you know, MSIE,
yep, Internet
Office
Explorer.
2000, those kinds of products are becoming more and more accessible and using native active accessibility code within them and other approaches to accessibility. Microsoft is actually holding itself out now in many cases as a producer of accessible software, and that's exactly what we were hoping would happen, that they would ultimately begin to take some ownership of their effort rather than just being a response system to consumer criticism. So if you look at it 10 years ago, we were nowhere with Microsoft. 5 years ago, we were just beginning to make a difference in terms of getting company consciousness. In these last 5 years, everybody, including Bill Gates, has said, okay, we're signing up, we're getting on board, let's go fight the war for accessibility. We're not there yet in all areas, but I think we're a lot further than we've ever been before, and I think we can look forward to a day, maybe might take another 10 years or so, but I think we look forward to a day from that out of the box, software will be accessible and usable by blind people, and we won't be having these big lags of 5 and 10 years to catch up again.
Let's talk about coalitions a little bit more, because you've mentioned how well the ACB works with other disability organizations on issues where there is common interest. Are there dangers in that approach as well? There appears to be a bit of reluctance among some to go down the coalition road. Do blind people sometimes have to compromise what's best for them in these situations?
That's a good... Somebody must give me the right question to ask. That's a hot topic. I am one of those people who basically has a healthy skepticism with respect to coalitioning. I'm under no circumstances would ACB agree that we are, quote, disabled people without first having said we are blind people. And the danger of using the label disability community to describe all persons with discrete disabilities is exactly that the public and people with disabilities themselves begin to see themselves as part of that major big lump of disability community and ultimately give up on important things that need to get done for themselves. And that's a real danger. And so, and the politicians love it, because if you go to a public politician and say, well, I'm representing the disability community and we want these three major issues, the likelihood is that those three major issues may globally impact upon the issues of blind people, but not likely to be issues that we would be, we're going to fall on our sword over. So access to information, for example, Clearly, accessibility as an issue is an issue, but if you don't define that in terms that are meaningful for blind people, it doesn't mean anything to us.
Is it not true that when people think of accessibility, most people think ramps?
Yeah, exactly. And that's a problem. When you think about deinstitutionalization, for example, does that mean that older blind people in nursing homes are necessarily going to get the support services they need? Don't know that that's true. These are the kinds of issues that on the one hand, we clearly support people with different disabilities in the issues that they have, because the only way we can ultimately expect them to support us is by supporting that. On the other hand, we do not, and never will, I hope, ever endorse the notion that there's cross-disability means one size fits all. It just doesn't. And it's a misconception that some people have about ACB, I think, that is wrong. And we've done our best in the last couple of years to correct that perception. Having said all that, though, let's remember that we do live in a world. The world is filled with people who are, in many ways, they either have no disabilities or some form of disability. And ACB, if blind people are going to be successful as members of that global community, then we need to work with other people to work on their issues and our common issues. And we certainly do a lot of that. The big issue, I think, for us right now is making sure that our members, along with other folks in the blindness community, understand that there's no way that ACB or any other blindness organization should see itself as the disabled community rather than the blind organization.
Because you're fighting against the tide, really, aren't you, in the sense that there is a series now of state agencies that are disability generic in nature, and blindness gets lumped in with those. That must be a real battle, because the whole Western world is going to this generic approach to disability.
Well, yeah, it's not just disability, it's everything. The political solution seems to be combine things, save on administrative cost, and in on a good day, reinvest those savings in the purpose of the organizations that you combined. On a bad day, just keep those monies for your own uses. This is not something that we can take very lightly. It is a serious threat to blind people, because we know that in those agencies where generic models have been adopted, that the interest of blind people was certainly not served, and that blind folks usually end up, if getting any services at all, it's somebody else's idea of what you ought to get rather than what you really need. So ACB has been very active, and we are increasingly and happily so forming alliances with other groups of blind people, including the Federation, to show a united front as it relates to these issues of separate services and identifiable services for blind people. And it's working. I mean, I think a year ago, I think people would have had perhaps a little less optimism about it than we have now. But I think what we've shown is that we've been able to resist successfully, in most cases, attempts to generalize the blindness agencies. And we also are beginning to create new ones where there were none before. So I think what's making the difference is a rising consciousness within blind people that our issues count, that we count, and that we don't have to see ourselves as just another part of the larger disability community. And I think that really does make a difference, because when we talk to people, decision makers, even though they're tempted to want to see us as simply another piece of a larger puzzle, they ultimately have to come to grips with the reality that we're not going away, and our issues are important. And that does make a difference.
Now, it was you, actually, that mentioned the Federation for the first time in this interview, and that leads to some questions about how lobbying is made more difficult when the Council and the Federation take opposing views. So if you get one group of blind people going to a legislator saying that they want this, and another group saying no, they don't, who does the legislator believe, and is that generally not a major problem for blind people in general?
Well, I don't know that it's been an overriding issue for blindness community in general. I do think there have been some pretty glaring examples of where it's been a real issue, especially around detectable warnings and accessible traffic signals. I think that that's the bad news, and you're right. I'm not gonna recite what you just said because it's true. I mean, legislators are not necessarily, well, they might be happy because they get, you know, well, you guys can't make up your mind, so we don't have to do anything. But I think increasingly and on average, we're showing that when it comes to issues that are of upfront importance to blind people, that we either form a united front to deal with those issues or that we work together in advance of whatever advocacy scheme that we develop so that people out there are not able to take advantage of that apparent split in opinion. And I think also on the issues, ACB, NFB, and other groups, you know, I think we all have to come to terms with whatever happened in the past happened. What we need to do now is to take a real serious look at what are the substantive issues that are a matter of public import that divide us, and are there ways that we might be able to reconcile those issues? I think, for example, with accessible traffic signals and with detectable warnings and any number of issues that ACB and NFB seemingly have differences about. The differences aren't really in the substance. They're more in the way that you view them. And I think we can come to some levels of agreement if we can get talking to each other, and that's happening now. So I'm real optimistic about that. Now, there's obviously going to be differences between the organizations that probably never go away, and that's okay. I mean, there's some people have one way of looking at the world, and other people have another way of looking at the world, and that's fine. The real bottom line here is whether or not when the world of blind people is at risk, there really is no ability of any organization, in my view, to legitimately stand in the way of making sure that blind people are okay.
Do you perceive a time coming where there might once again be a merger of the two organizations?
If it is coming, it's a long way off. I mean, there's no question that the approach that ACB takes in terms of a sort of hyper-democracy where we're real conscious and aware of and always attempt to find every way possible for the individual to be heard and dialogue to occur and consensus to happen, that takes a long time, and that's and sometimes it's risky business, but that's democracy as it in its well, perhaps some people would say extreme form. On the other side of the equation is the Federation has a much more disciplined approach to the way that they deal with issues and identify issues and work with their membership, and for some people that's a choice that they would rather make in terms of how an organization should operate, so that's clearly okay. The bottom line is that we're probably never going to be able to reconcile those things, not as long as current organizations as I know them exist. The reason for ACB's existence is because there was a real disagreement within the Federation as to certain ways of operating, and that disagreement hasn't necessarily gone away. Hopefully the harmful things about it, the things that keep us apart on important issues, will disappear. But I think over time we'll probably evolve like any other community with having different ways of expressing our views and organizations to do that. Again, though, and I think it's important as an object lesson for all blind people around the world, is that you know, when we go about the business of advocating for blind people, we have to bear in mind that we are advocating for a community and not just necessarily our own view of that community. And so we need to be open to that and to make sure that all organizations, to the extent that it's possible, avoid conflicts which are really counterproductive and unnecessary.
As executive director, do you find that the processes that the ACB is committed to in terms of democracy impede your ability to respond to issues in a timely manner at times?
You mean that they drive me crazy? I don't think so. You know, maybe it's just my own personal bent in the way that I see decisions best made, but I'm very supportive and enjoy the discourse that happens within ACB before things happen. And as an organization, we have taken certain measures to ensure that when action is necessary and has to get done, that there are mechanisms in place so that the president and the executive board and the board and the executive director can can make things happen a lot more quickly than in the past. So I think we've recognized as an organization there are times when you have to be a bit more decisive and quick about what you're doing, and at the same time protect the interest of the membership from having a top-heavy bureaucracy that doesn't really pay a lot of attention to their issues. So I think we sort of worked out a pretty good compromise in ACB.
It is sometimes said that the ACB doesn't articulate a clear philosophy of blindness. Is that a fair comment?
Well, maybe from the perspective that if you want to have a laundry list of how to live your life, then I suppose that our way of doing business isn't necessarily for you, only because we don't subscribe to the notion of a black and white, well-delineated world. We accept the fact that the world is gray in many cases, and that people have to use their own resources and intelligence and cooperation with other people to ultimately find a way to cope with this thing we call life. So that, philosophically speaking, I suppose one could say that democracy in and of itself is not a very well articulated philosophy. And to that extent, I suppose ACB would have to claim itself guilty. On the other hand, I think we have a clear philosophy that we're for things rather than being against them. We're for blind people being proactive. We're for blind people having opportunities. We're for blind people being able to get the necessary training that they need to be successful. We're for the environment being friendly to the interests of blind people, just as it has to be friendly to the interests of sighted people. Those things that benefit blind people and also benefit the rest of the world to the extent that can be done are things that we're for. So, yeah, I mean, I think we have a real philosophy, and not only is it real, but I think it's also alive. It clearly does not rely upon some doctrine developed many years ago and then distilled to the masses. I mean, it relies upon a set of values that are affirmative values, and that people make decisions dynamically from that. So, yeah, I'd say we have a philosophy. It may not be the most easy one to discern, but we sure have one.
Is it morally and intellectually possible for one person to belong to both organizations?
I believe that's true. There's a political answer for you. Is it impossible? I believe that's true. What does he mean by that? See, I'm in Washington. I learn all these things.
I can tell,
yeah. Yeah, right. From my perspective, and I think the ACB's perspective, I know from ACB's perspective, we want the individual to be as informed as possible about whatever they're about to do. And if a person either wants to belong to both organizations simply to become better informed, or if they want to belong to both organizations because they've concluded within themselves that both organizations have an advantage or offer them an advantage in their lives, then I think that's a perfectly good decision to make. And I know that NFB has graduated away from the old position they had where, you know, you couldn't serve two masters. To a much more broader perspective, and I don't want to pretend to speak for them, but as I understand it, they don't really have a problem with rank and file people belonging to both organizations either.
Because when I mentioned that I'd be speaking with you, I got a couple of emails from people who said that they find it very frustrating at both a state and a national level that ACB and NFB functions coincide, particularly the conventions and also often even chapter meetings. And maybe there are people who are at the stage of their lives where they want to check out both organizations and see what they deliver. Is there any chance that there might be some sort of agreement about shifting convention dates so that both don't occur at the same time?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and I'm appreciative of the fact that people bring it up. And I think probably, you know, I guess I never really thought a whole lot about, you know, when the dates of things happen, but probably there was in the past there may have been some competition between the two organizations with respect to dates or whatever. I think ACB is open to looking at ways of accommodating our membership, and to the extent that we can do that as a benefit to those people who want to be able to go off to the other convention or whatever. I suppose we could look at that. I don't know that we'd ever change any dates as a result of that perception. I mean, the reality is that I think the dates are set more as a result of some decision-making process that has to do with people getting time off during the summer and wanting to be able to get involved with a convention. But, you know, I've heard the discussion about Labor Day or Memorial Day or some other alternative, and that's something we're certainly open to discuss in our convention and organization. And who knows? I mean, someday we may actually come up with a new date for the convention, which wouldn't bother me much because, you know, I'd love to be able to go someplace nice in the fall or the spring.
Yes, well, it'll also be interesting to see where the Blaze Engineering comes then.
Well, now we get into a bit of controversy here, you see.
Well, what's the story with that? I mean, it seems an interesting decision for a vendor who has customers in an organization to make that kind of a decision.
I don't know. It's incomprehensible to me, as a thinking person, why a company would toss over all that business simply for reasons of loyalty to NFB. I think, you know, Dean has been pretty upfront about his feelings and conclusions on the matter. ACB certainly has not been very happy with that. We think that would be fine if the marketplace were large enough and there were enough companies in competition so that would just be one company that decides to do that, and we'd have alternatives. I think we're real concerned that whenever you have a company that has a virtual monopoly or a close to monopoly on certain products and then it decides that it's going to favor one organization over another, irrespective of whether it's ACB or NFB, I think that creates a real problem for the blind community at large. And so ACB's very right to be concerned about what happened with respect to Mr. Blasey. Hopefully he'll change his mind at some point and begin to realistically support members of both organizations at their conventions and other meetings. But, you know, that day isn't here yet, so all we can say at this point in time is hopefully that day will come, and if it doesn't come, that competition will be created sufficient so that blind people will have a choice as to what products to buy.
I suppose the irony is that if there were more competition, the vendor wouldn't be able to be quite as selective, I would think.
Right, exactly. And that's why we like this democracy idea, because it tends to mitigate against the extremes.
I must say you have an extraordinarily good website, and a lot of work is obviously going into that as a means of communicating with people.
We really do believe that at the heart of a live and good organization is its ability to tell its own story and to make sure that its members and friends have options to get information and to use that information productively. And we have invested a lot of time and effort with respect to our website. I mean, Early News is an excellent webmaster. Chris Gray has done a great job of getting supports for the website and for our other electronic activities. Brian Charlson, as you know, is an expert in technology, and he heads up the information piece of ACB in terms of oversight operations. I think the website's a wonderful example of what we can do as blind people once we set our mind to it. And I have to say, that I go into that website and I listen to the ACB song a lot because I like it. And I think it's a fun song. But also there's a lot of serious stuff on the website as well, as you know, ranging from pedestrian safety stuff to job opportunities. And we even have an online donation link now on the website that people will be able to use a secure server to be able to make donations to ACB, which is something that we obviously would appreciate. But we try to add more and more links to it. We're trying to make sure that our affiliates can be gotten to, at least the information about them on the website, so that people have realistic options and opportunities to join ACB or to take advantage of issues that we've raised and find ways to support those issues in their own lives. And it's working. I mean, we get lots of lots of feedback from people who have visited the website, either in terms of joining the organization or supporting the causes that we support.
Well, the other good thing for people like me is that you've made a real valiant effort over the last couple of years to netcast the conventions, which is great.
Yeah, that's something that we think is great, and we're actually getting some corporate support for, and hopefully each year it's going to get a lot better to the point where someday you'll be able to sit down at your computer and just flip a switch and there you go, the ACB convention live and in color, you know, with oldsters like, you know, me by that time, you know. Yeah, I remember when that person ran for president, and the whole story and the whole thing. But I think I think that websites and the internet are powerful tools of communication and growth for an organization and our people, and I also think they're fun. So I think that, and I know that ACB agrees with this, I mean, that we're trying to really take the future and sort of drag it into now, make the opportunities that we always talk about real for today. And so the website and the internet utilization is part of that, and I think we're getting somewhere with that. We really are. And another nice thing about that is you can share so much information and link literally to any number of other interest groups and concerned people around the world simply by just having a good website. So we do a lot of work on that, you're right.
One of the things you brought up earlier that I wanted to follow up was about the work that the ACB does with rehabilitation agencies. And this appears to me to be another contrast between the Federation and the ACB, which is that the Federation now appears to be getting into service provision in a major way, whereas the ACB has quite clearly set itself as a consumer organization and not a provider of services. Do you think that that's an important distinction?
Well, it certainly is an important distinction. If you don't have a consumer community that has the independence to be able to rightfully understand and respond to either counterproductive practices or other issues that may happen in the training system, then you don't really have a check on what that training system is able to do. And if a training system gets developed that, for whatever reason, works against the interest of the consumer population, then without checks and balances, there's just no way that consumers are ever going to get anywhere in terms of benefiting from that system. You know, so having said that, I think it's reasonable and I think fair to look at the NFB experience from, at least, you know, our perspective, in that there is a line of argument that says, who better to do the service than somebody who's had the experience? And that's an argument that we've used with state agencies for years, that they ought to hire blind people because we know about blindness. And so by extension, I suppose one could argue from the Federation point of view, and I don't know that I've ever heard this argument from them, so certainly, again, I'm not trying to speak for them, but I would speculate that they probably would argue that, well, we've created these systems because the old system didn't work. We, from our own experience as consumers, have been able to devise a system that benefits blind people from what we've learned to be good in terms of delivering services. So I'm sure that they would make that argument, and there's some credibility in that. I think that's not a bad argument to make. I mean, obviously, the issue then becomes, well, once you've created this perfect training system, are there interests or variables out there that can compromise your ability to deliver services in a way that is best for consumers? And I think that's where they get into trouble with the training centers and other service provision, that there is a natural inclination to protect your own interest and your economic viability. There's also the issue of what happens when somebody disagrees with a philosophical point of view that you put into practice in your training program. If they're not allowed to work that through, whether they ultimately agree with you or not, then what happens in that circumstance is that the taxpayer is just not getting the benefit of their tax investment in that service. So there are natural problems with it, to be sure. ACB has taken the position that we, if we get involved with that kind of situation at all, it would be very minimal, and certainly as a national organization, we're not likely to do that. It doesn't mean that we're better than anybody else. What it really does mean is that we see this as an issue that we have to maintain our objectivity.
So there may come a time, in fact, when the ACB advocates to the NFB as a service provider on behalf of aggrieved clients.
That's an interesting... That's Orwellian. I mean, that's like 1984 in 1999. That's a fantastic concept. And you're right. I mean, there's going to be... there are going to be times when somebody who is using an NFB service will find themselves in a situation where they believe, and we would agree, their rights have been trampled on, or they didn't have access to something they needed or whatever. And I don't know that we would, to put it in the framework of ACB going to NFB as an advocate, maybe a bit off. I mean, it would be likely that certainly as reasonable people, we would want to talk to the service provider first before going anywhere else, but we would have no hesitation to go higher than that, as it were, to make sure that the rights of consumers were honored.
And just finally, I've heard whispers around the place about a history of the ACB that's being written. Can you tell us anything about that?
Yes, the history of the history. I mean, I have to tell you that this history has been in the making for a long time in terms of people writing it, and there have been not so much any disputes over factual errors or anything like that, as much as their writing style and approaches and all that sort of thing have been topics of hot discussion within the Board of Publications and other places. And but finally, I think people can look forward to a well-written and well-documented history of not only ACB, but also the larger blindness community issues. And I think that'll be out by the end of next year. So I'm actually looking forward to reading it. I've seen the table of contents, and I suppose I could do one of those Star Wars things now, coming to a theater near you. But I think... from what I read in terms of the table of contents, it's going to be a fascinating book, and I think it will benefit every blind person to read it. I mean, one of the things that, as a community, we need to make sure we're always in touch with our roots, and that, irrespective of organization, there are great people in the past that have done so much for our community, and after they die off, it just seems like they've faded off into history. Well, the positive things that they've done should be celebrated.
And does the book have a title at this stage?
I think it does, but I'd rather not say.
Fair enough. Your lips are sealed.
Yes. That only raises the interest in the world community out there, right? Look at all these messages to ACB now. I want the first copy.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure a lot of people will be interested in reading it. So you're actually going back to the formation of the Federation and looking at that from an ACB perspective?
Yes. It predates ACB's formation.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, and from the table of contents I saw, I have to say that it looked like a fascinating read. So.
Yeah, that sounds pretty...
Yeah, it's a good thing for all of us to really sort of get a sense of who we are as a larger community, too, and not just individuals within individual organizations.
Well, we've raised a lot of issues here that we probably could have discussed each of them in depth for a lot longer, but I appreciate you giving up an hour or so of your time. And after the interview, of course, we have a phone-in section, so it'll be interesting to hear what people call in and say after some very interesting thoughts that you've raised, and it's good to have you on the program.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed this.